This podcast edition of Section D first aired on the 21st of February 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour, here on Monocle 24. I'm Hugo MacDonald. We've got a cracking show for you this week, delving deep into the world of architecture. We'll be visiting two groundbreaking exhibitions, talking to two of the biggest names in the industry, and popping into one or two buildings along the way. Coming up in the show, I drop in on a spectacular abandoned building project with the best view in Hungary, overlooking the city of Budapest.
Well, and this whole idea comes from decoding the city of Budapest. And if you look around, the city is not homogeneous.
We sit down in Stockholm with Danish darling of the architecture world, Bjarke Ingels, to talk hedonistic sustainability.
The main focus of architecture is not to do architecture or to do even sustainable architecture. It is to make sure that our cities and buildings actually fit with the way we want to live our lives.
And we bolt over to Bahrain to check in on the team that won the Golden Lion at the 2010 Venice Architecture Biennale.
We didn't really want to participate by defending or explaining these positions, but rather to try to understand the social consequences that these vast urban development projects are having on the local society.
All that, plus we hear about Cuba's National Art School, tinkle the ivories with Rafael Vignoli in New York, and take a tour of the RIBA's new exhibition, A Place to Call Home. That's all to come on this week's Section D. Stay tuned. Hello and welcome to Section D. First up, we're heading to Budapest, where an enterprising young man by the name of Botond Bognor snapped up a prime piece of empty land in 1996. Overlooking the entire city, at the foot of the castle, he set about gaining permission to build a villa that would be part cultural institution and part public space for his home city. He enlisted the mighty help of Tado Ando and Ilse Crawford to realise his ambition, and building duly began. A year ago, though, building stopped, leaving the shell of a beautiful, intriguing creation standing empty and abandoned. Botond told me the story of Villa Budapest while standing on the terrace overlooking the city.
Well, it has several layers of significance, and because it's not only on the side of a hill, but on one of the most significant site or point of the hill, because at a certain moment of history, it was there was a medieval road passing through where they were carrying water. At a later point, in the 16th century, there was a Turkish fortress put on this road to protect the castle. Yet in a later moment in the 19th century, the prime minister thought that his house should be best on the top of the Turkish fortress. And then, well, in the Second World War, when it was bombed down, it became an empty site. And I think an empty site is always crying out for some invention, some new contemporary idea, and this is how the rebirth of the villa was basically taking place in the 21st century.
And you started by rebuilding the villa as it had been, and then enlisted the help of some of the world's greatest minds and creatives to sort of do something a little bit different. So who's on board?
Well, in fact, the board is quite big because there's a huge team working on the villa, starting obviously with the archaeologists who started out the digs. But I'm very proud to say that Tado Ando is on our board, who is taking care of the interiors of the villa, and Ilse Crawford, who is also taking care of the interiors of the villa at a special place that is the restaurant and the salon. But Ando is taking place or designing most of the public spaces inside.
And the villa, just describe exactly what the project is about. It's a performance space, but also it's creating a public space for people in Budapest and visitors and tourists to come and enjoy the city.
Well, because I believe that this is one of the most prominent places. That's why I also believe that it shouldn't be a place for private privileges, but for the greater number of people and visitors, locals and international alike. So I thought, why don't we turn this space into a public space where you can enjoy social life, food, And then why not art? Because I just didn't want to create a nice place or a cool place, but I wanted to create a meaningful place where you take away something with you, and that is, of course, the experience. But I wanted to flavor it through art.
And you can't just call up Tado Ando and ask him to come and build something. How did you manage to get him involved in the project?
I'm extremely lucky to be born in a family with architects. And one of them, who is my uncle, he knows Ando since about 30 or 35 years. And he knows him since his beginning of his career. And when I concluded, with a little bit of help, that I need a world-class architect for the interiors, I turned to him and I said, well, what do you think? So I was considering several other architects as well, but I narrowed down and I targeted and put Ando on the top of the list. And he said, I can help you with one phone call to meet him, but it's no guarantee that he would accept the job because he's very choosy. And well, at the end of the day, I flew to Osaka and I got his okay and go.
And it's unusual also that Ando is working on a project with another very great interior designer, Ilse Crawford. What's it like working with both of them together? I mean, it must be complicated at times.
Well, this whole idea comes from decoding the city of Budapest. And if you look around, the city is not a homogeneous architecture. It's very heterogeneous. So, and the villa, and no wonder it's Villa Budapest, is a quintessence of the city. In that sense, I had no problem whatsoever to work with different great minds. In fact, I think it cries out for different great minds. And if I call the word eclectic in hand, which the original meaning is choose or selection, I wanted to put it together as a beautiful puzzle where one thing is not overshining the other. So, in fact, for me, it was very natural to work with different minds. And I must say that I was a little bit worried that these people would not be comfortable. However, it worked out beautifully. And then all of them, I think they are happy with the result.
Now, the result is what we're standing in at the moment. And it's a building site still. The shell is here, and you can feel how special the space is. It's not just the views, but it's also the history and the space that's been created here. But work has stopped a year ago. And, I mean, how does it feel for you? You're struggling to find the money to complete it. And Hungary, obviously, is going through a very difficult financial situation at the moment. Do you feel like, will it ever be completed?
Well, the villa will be completed at some point, for sure. The question is, am I going to be the one to complete it? Because I believe that a building should be used, because the greatest wrongdoing with a real estate when it's not used. So if I'm not going to be able to finish myself, then I will sell the building, and then the new owner will finish it to his or her will. We are not there yet. So obviously I feel I would feel very sad to let the villa go and to be completed differently, because I believe that this building should be for the public, should be accessible for the public. And well, there's the future to see. The future will tell how it will develop. But the time, the decision moment is coming.
And you believe very graciously that the project is more important than your involvement in it?
I believe so, yes. Because we are standing in a site which has been used since the 12th century. So my story, which is merely 16 years, this is nothing compared to the big picture. So if it remains a construction site for too long, then obviously there will be damage in the ruins and then in what we have already completed, and it shouldn't be done that way. And I don't believe that there are owners of real estates, but I believe that there are caretakers of real estates, because all the real estates are outliving their owners. So it's in fact the other way around.
It will break my heart if you don't finish it.
Well, you are not alone. As I said, there's a huge team helping me, and I really want to mention the local team as well, because there's a fantastic group of people, local architects. His name is Kerényi and Bordás, who actually manage the day-to-day work as well. And then around these people, there are obviously the constructors and my colleagues, so there's a huge number of people on board waiting to continue the work.
And, I mean, you mentioned the fact that this is a part of the city, obviously a very historic part of the city, but what has the city's attitude been to the work that you've done here over the last 16 years? Have you come up against difficulties in trying to persuade people that this is something that the city needs?
Short answer is no. Longer answer, I think by the time now they started to appreciate that intention and that quality work which we put in is enriching the city. So yes, I met a lot of opposition. In fact, it was extremely difficult to get the permit. We had a lot of trouble. But by the time, I think, and the persistency convinced the decision makers that this is something for the good. And today I have some support. But unfortunately, this is not the kind of support what I need.
That was me with Botond Bognor in Budapest. And sticking with the theme of unfinished spaces, it's time to head to New York. Our writer there, Barrett Austin, sat down with Alisa Namias, who, together with Benjamin Murray, have made a film telling the story of Cuba's National Arts School. Started in 1961, it remains uncompleted to this day. The film, titled Unfinished Spaces, is a beautiful ode to Castro's vision that Cuba would be home to the greatest arts institution in the world.
My name is Alisa Namias, and I'm the co-director and co-producer of Unfinished Spaces.
The citizens of Havana come out in force to welcome the living.
Unfinished Spaces is the story of the Cuban National Art Schools, which were designed from 1961 to 65 in Cuba, and the three architects who designed them, Ricardo Porro, Vittorio Garatti, and Roberto Gottardi. And it's the story of their vision from the 60s and also the persecution they faced during the Cold War and exile, and then their triumphant return to Cuba to finish the project.
For Namias, a former student of architecture, Cuba was a land long defined by its grand Spanish colonial buildings. It wasn't until she visited over a decade ago that she was exposed to the revolutionary buildings of 1960s Cuba.
Well, the Cuban National Art Schools were unlike any other architecture I had seen in Cuba. They were not the stereotypical and beautiful colonial architecture, and they weren't the 1950s modern style. It was a real combination of modernist organic architecture a la Frank Lloyd Wright or even Alvar Aalto, and it was in Cuba. So it was this real marriage of modernism and tropical climate and materials like terracotta. But also what really inspired me to make a film about them were the fact that the spaces were so cinematic, but also that the story of the construction paralleled the revolution itself, so that there was a kind of metaphor for a larger historical and political moment.
In the film, Namias and Murray tell the story of the school's founding. As the story goes, Fidel Castro and Che Guevara decided to play a round of golf, what they saw as the foolish sport of Cuba's idle elite. While on the grounds of Havana's most storied country club, Castro envisioned fairways replaced by a national art school, one he hoped would become the finest in the world. In true revolutionary spirit, Castro soon selected three talented architects and provided a strict 2-month timeline for the building's completion. From its inception, the young architects saw it as a dream commission. While the school would ultimately open, troubles within the revolution posed unique challenges for the architects and the buildings themselves.
Well, the dream of the school, of the pedagogical aspect, was realized. So the schools did open. They've always been open. Every single artist that you'll meet around the world right now since the 1960s who's from Cuba went to that school. So the buildings were unfinished, but the pedagogical dream survived. But the building dream, the dream of the architectural space took a major turn in 1965. There was a man in the Ministry of Construction who was Porro's nemesis. They did not see eye to eye on anything. And this man, another architect named Antonio Quintana, did everything he could to make Porro's life difficult. And Ricardo Porro had to step down from his position at the School of Architecture on the faculty, and the two of them feuded, which eventually it's said that Quintana, according to Porro and others, it's said that Quintana was able to cut the funding for the construction. So the buildings were almost finished, 90% finished, and they were stopped.
I knew that something was wrong. I understood that no more was going to be built by my hand. So I was going to lose my life. And I love my life. I don't want to lose it. Not because they are going to kill me, but because I wouldn't do anything else. I made a very individual architecture, and they wanted Soviet architecture. And as I was forbidden, I could not work anymore in my architecture, or I had to do awful things as they were doing, and I decided to leave Cuba.
As Namias and Murray suggest, the politics of the revolution would begin to shift shortly after the commissioning of the National Art School. The increasing influence of the Soviet Union left many of the original dreams of Cuba's revolution undone. As the film describes, the pervasive influence of Sovietization extended even to the architecture of the small island nation. As the urbanism of Havana suggests, the Soviet-style prefabrication, ideally suited for Moscow but not for the tropics, eventually found its place as the chosen building method of Castro's regime. The artistic modernist styles put forth by Butarde, Porro, and Garotti ultimately proved useless to the regime's shifting vision for Cuban society. While the academic institutions have remained firmly in existence from their inception, the buildings are all but finished. In a strange political twist portrayed in the films, the architects were recently invited back to Cuba to complete their vision. Heavily strained by Cuba's challenged economic system, the project marches on, slowly but triumphantly.
I think this is the reason why we called the film Unfinished Spaces. There are the unfinished spaces of the buildings, and there are the unfinished emotional spaces in the architects' lives and their creative spaces that were sort of left open. And then there's the unfinished space of the political space of the revolution. And then of the concept of utopia in general, it always has to be unfinished, right? As soon as you say, we've done it, it's no longer a utopia. It's no longer a projection. It's no longer a hope. And this is a story about that, about striving to do that, to realize that utopia and not realizing it, or thinking you have and you haven't. And in that way, we can relate to it on so many levels. And in that way, it is a metaphor for the revolution that wanted to be open, but ossified in certain ways as well.
That was Barrett Austin in New York with Alisa Namias, one half of the directing producing team of Unfinished Spaces. Time for a song now, and keeping with the theme thus far, this is Empty Room by Arcade Fire. That was Empty Room by Arcade Fire. Time for a quick break, but do stay with us. We'll be hearing about architect Raphael Vignoli's passion for pianos after this.
The Globalist bids goodnight to America, good morning to Europe, and good afternoon to Asia with 2 hours of analysis, paper reviews, and a run through the topical stories shaping the world wherever you are.
The issue of reform and, again, how society forms itself post this crisis is playing a leading role.
Tune in every weekday at 6 a.m. London time.
Welcome back to Section D. Raphael Vignoli was born in Uruguay, but has been a resident of New York City for over 30 years. Best known for projects like the Tokyo International Forum and Carrasco International Airport, his firm is now overseeing the development of the Battersea Power Station in London. Our New York editor, Aisha Spears, went by to ask him about a few of his favourite things and discovered that above and beyond anything, Vignoli's studio holds examples of his most treasured pastime, piano playing.
I have been collecting these instruments for many, many years. I have something like 19 or something.
19
like that.
Piano.
And I have them in every place I go. And I mean, when I worked in Japan, I had an electric piano because, you know, we were working in the job site. And it's something that it is probably for me a very sort of kind of strange psychological basis. I mean, you know, I started playing when I was very, very young and played for a number of years. And then I wanted to become a professional pianist. And you know, then architecture showed up and I chickened out. And
How often do you play these pianos?
I come here every time. I mean, if you weren't here, I would be playing.
How many hours a day do you play?
This is, as I'm sure you know, I mean, you know, for people that really are into this. I mean, this is the only thing that you could do for hours on end. I mean, you know, and I feel always pulled to go back up and do some work. Because, I mean, if I could, I would stay here for forever. And that is a remarkable connection, because it sort of kind of gives you this sort of sense of participation. It's the only thing that if you don't do it very well, it doesn't matter really quite. Yeah. I mean, you know, that when you, it's all about practicing too. Yeah. It's all about the fact that you can measure progress in ways that are really unique. I mean, it's sort of like exercising, but with this sort of kind of aesthetic component, which is really so remarkable for me. I mean, and it is so much different than anything I can see in the kind of world in which I move, right? Because it's all about practicality and sort of kind of, you know, issues that have very little to do with depth, right?
Yeah.
But the object itself is fascinating. I mean, you know, I've had many upright pianos. I mean, vertical is an expression in Spanish, but it is upright pianos. And pianos of different order and origin. But, you know, what it is remarkable is that it is such a kind of closed circuit as a form making, right? Because, you know, it's one of the few things in which you can recognize the evolution of the style as if it was an applied component to the object, yeah. Right? I was reading last night a very interesting book written by a French piano teacher, mm-hmm. Castro is her name, and it had these sections and vertical cross-sections of the instrument explaining how the action works, which, of course, I know after so many years, but it may be like an acquired taste in a way. I mean, like something that, you know, you just cannot explain rationally. Mm-hmm. But the instrument itself is evolutionary. I mean, you know, at a certain point, the history of the harpsichord and many other, the harp, so mm-hmm. starting from the harp, I mean, there is a breakthrough in which a very simple mechanical idea, which is this idea of the release of the hammer, right, implemented in absolutely low-tech bases. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, you don't need, you know, carbon fiber or any of that.
Yeah.
Kind of, it's just simply how you improve the ability of the pressure on the key to be able to release the hammer, right? And to me, that is an absolutely unbelievable piece of design. I mean, when you really look inside the piano, there is this sort of kind of micro world of the action, and then there is sort of master, particularly in grand pianos like this enormous object, which is, you tend to believe that it is cultural, but it has absolutely nothing to do with culture. I mean, in the sense of an aesthetic will, say, is basically the meaning of the harp sort of incorporated into the box.
Is there any object that really does kind of embody how you feel about your business and architecture itself?
I always travel with a very simple bag that has only two things, a computer and a lot of, you know, freehand instruments and a sketchbook. My father, when I was, I think, 14, it gave me a Caran d'Ache lead holder, right? Mm-hmm. That I have had since 1967 or 8. And I had, for instance, sort of not only fallen into lakes and swimming pools with it, but also crashed my car with it. And so it's kind of like practically totally destroyed, but I still have it. That's the psychotic part, because it's totally connected to, you know, personal aspects of the story. But I do have this sort of totally frustrating relationship with great pieces of writing or drawing instruments that get discontinued. When you really finally get it right, somebody decides that it's not anymore needed. There are two things from Pentel and one from Mitsubishi that I just learned last week, to my dismay, after having bought 100 of them. And that are not being fabricated anymore. One is a felt pen, and the other one is a self-loaded brush that is from Mitsubishi, that is the most ductile instrument that you can imagine, a typical writing instrument for writing in Japanese. But it has this absolutely perfect blacking to it. And I guess it should be like a synthetic brush of some sort, but it is super flexible, so you can actually make very thin lines and very thick lines at the same time. And basically charcoal, that is really, you know, unbelievably ductile too. For many, many, many years, I used to travel with a watercolor box. And I still use it, but it is more for satisfaction than for this sort of kind of working type of connection to the hand drawing. The back and forth between the different levels of representation, it is an enormously fundamental component of how the history of architecture has evolved. And I think that the tools actually teach you what to do. So the freedom that comes with something that it is so amazingly generic. I mean, you know, this NARB curves, for instance. I mean, it is a mathematical idea that replaces every single previous definition of how you understood geometry. And that, to me, is a liberating aspect, and one that, you know, it frightens many, many of us. I mean, at the time in which, you know, you come to the limit of your capacity to understand.
That was our New York editor, Aisha Spears, in architect Raphael Vignoli's office. We're off to Bahrain next. It's been 2 years since the tiny Gulf Island nation of Bahrain first appeared at the Venice Architecture Biennale and surprised everyone, including their own curators, by winning the coveted Golden Lion Award. Today, Bahrain is in the headlines for less positive reasons: ongoing protests and violent government crackdowns. But the situation hasn't stopped the country's architects debating local issues. Monocle's Amy Gutman sat down with Noura Saya, curator of the winning Biennale exhibition, to learn how Bahrain is using current events to turn away from the world stage and look inwards instead.
Just 28 years old, Noura Saya is head of architectural affairs at the Ministry of Culture and helped put Bahrain on the design map when she curated her very first exhibition 2 years ago. It was also the first time Bahrain participated in the Venice Biennale. We meet at Noura's office in Bahrain's Fort Museum. The modern building is dramatically lit to set visitors up for the view of the sun setting over the Gulf. It's a striped painting of oranges and purples in full view thanks to the floor-to-ceiling doors of the museum's cafe flung wide open. An inner courtyard feels like a sanctuary and the perfect place to talk design.
How intimidating was it to turn up at the Venice Biennale, this tiny Gulf island, having never shown there before, with all the stereotypes that must have come with it?
It was incredibly intimidating. At the same time, I think it was challenging and really interesting because of the stereotypes you mentioned. I think we had a lot of stereotypes that we wanted to defend. There was a lot of things, misconceptions. We thought it would be a great opportunity to talk about. And I think that's one of the things that was quite central to the theme we decided to choose, that we didn't want to only, you know, respond to stereotypes or defend ourselves, but talk about the issues that we think are important for us to talk about at the time in Bahrain.
The issue was, and still is, land reclamation, a hot topic in the Gulf. The exhibit, titled Reclaim, explored Bahrain's declining sea culture. The nation with a history of pearl diving and fishermen has pushed its coastlines further and further away from modern society to accommodate urban development. Noura and her team tried to capture the fragility and vulnerability of the coast using shabby sea huts.
The issues of land reclamation are often talked about. There was a while in 2006, 2007, where, you know, every other week an image of a reclamation project either in Dubai, Qatar, or even Bahrain would make it on the front cover of a newspaper. But we didn't really want to participate by defending or explaining these positions, but rather to try to understand the social consequences that these vast urban development projects are having on the local society and the way that the local society is responding to these extensive changes. We thought that it was important for us to address locally.
How much did your presence and your victory at the Venice Biennale put Bahrain on the sort of world stage architecturally?
In an incredible way, I think, in a way that we would have never been able to imagine. It got us an enormous amount of publicity, that's for sure, but more importantly, it gave us a lot of credibility. One of the important things that we were trying to achieve was to try to kind of change the cultural equation that there was between Bahrain as a Gulf state and the rest of the world. I think, unfortunately, much too often, a lot of people view cultural exchange as in, you know, we'll sell you an exhibition and you give us the money and you gain some contact in return. What's really important for us to try to do here is to reverse that equation and to start producing content instead of importing it. The Venice Biennale was, you know, was a good occasion to start doing that, but a lot of the other things that we do here try to go in the same direction of showing that we're able to contribute beyond the financial means. We are able to contribute by actually producing quality content.
Establishing Bahrain as a place for quality content was key, but so was creating a platform for internal debate.
What we tried to do was, in fact, in some way kind of reverse the issue of the Venice Biennale. It wasn't really about demonstrating the achievements of a country, but rather to use the momentum that Venice offered to reflect on issues that maybe would have had trouble talking about here in Bahrain. The best thing about winning the Golden Lion wasn't the victory in itself, but was the fact that it got us a lot of publicity in Bahrain, and that the fact that it was so well received gave us an incredible boost to be able to talk about these issues here.
It's impossible to avoid the issue of the protests and the violent government reaction.
Last year, Bahrain didn't turn up for the Venice Biennale. How much of a setback do you think that was?
It was obviously a bit of a setback, you can't really deny that. But I think what's important to note was that what we tried to do at the Ministry of Culture is to implement cultural activities or exhibitions or whatever that are relevant to what's happening on the ground. And in respect to the political situation at the time, it wasn't a priority to participate in an international biennale like the Venice Biennale. It wasn't a priority in terms of our spending. It wasn't a priority in terms of the message that we wanted to circulate. At the time, it was a lot more important for us to focus on inward-looking issues. Last year, at the time that we were supposed to participate at the Venice Art Biennale, we hosted the annual Bahrain Summer Festival, which happens every year. That was really important for us to continue doing these events. A lot of people argued that it wasn't the time. For us, it's really important to reiterate that culture for us is not something luxurious or frivolous, but it's something that's essential in bringing people together, especially in difficult times like that. The shows were mostly all sold out. So I think what's always important to do is to make sure that you're always re-questioning yourself in terms of what is relevant to do. And I think you have to be self-critical enough to say, no, we won't participate this year because this is not the priority.
One of the ways Noura and her team are trying to pull the community together is through a competition to design a public square at the entrance to the old souk in Manama, where we continue our interview.
What we're trying to launch with this competition is more of a debate than actually a pragmatic solution for the square. I think the first question should be, what should a public space in Bahrain be like? Because there isn't really a set answer. You know, the history and the tradition of public spaces in Bahrain and the Gulf states is quite different from like a Western notion of what a public space should be. And at the same time, Bahrain and the other Gulf states have imported so much Western models, be it, you know, the mall, the highway. So it also asks the relevance of, you know, is a public space only the street and the zoo, or could it be something else? I mean, there's a lot to be said, there's a lot to be talked about, and this is what this competition tries to do, to ask the questions that will enable us to know better what should be planned or should not be planned.
Where would you like to see the creative community of Bahrain 2 years from now?
I'd like to see it being more engaged, probably in local issues, being more critical to what's happening, but in a positive sense, not being critical and being on the sidelines, but being critically engaged and trying to make a positive difference.
So more inward involvement rather than world stage?
I think so, yeah. I think at this stage, this is probably the most crucial.
The Reclaim exhibit was hailed for its lucid and forceful self-analysis. How relevant is that theme today?
There are issues there that everyone willingly admits that have been there for years and that we know we have to address. Culture is not something that only happens when everything is great and everyone is happy. On the contrary, we believe that culture is necessary, it's important, and it has a crucial role to play now, probably more than ever. And there are religious, sectarian divides. I think that's when culture is the most relevant.
So it involves not shying away from the difficult topics.
Of course. For us, it's really important to try to transform what happened into a positive creative energy.
Nora hopes some of the young protesters can play an important role in Bahrain's creative community. If the public debate can extend beyond culture, Bahrain might have a chance at another win. In Manama, for Monocle, I'm Amy Gutman.
And from Bahrain to Stockholm, it's time to hear from one of the world's most exciting architects. Bjarke Ingels, though still in his 30s, has transformed the architecture world with his practice big. Pushing the realms of possibility in terms of aesthetic and function, today he has over 35 projects in various stages of completion. Recently, he was in Stockholm to give a talk about the term he's coined, hedonistic sustainability. He sat down with our correspondent Elna Nikkanen Andersson.
The main focus of architecture is not to do architecture or to do even sustainable architecture. It is to make sure that our cities and buildings actually fit with the way we want to live our lives. And of course, we have to make our cities enjoyable and livable and inhabitable in a sustainable way. But the main purpose and like what's unique about human beings is that we have taken responsibility for designing the world the way we want to live in it. And as our presence on planet Earth is ever increasing in numbers, we get not only the responsibility to take care of our own life, but also take care of the lives of other plants and other animals. And in that sense, we have matured to a point where we have to become designers of ecosystems. We have the knowledge to sort of investigate how things work, how things interrelate, and we can start designing cities that are not the opposite of nature. It's not like absence of nature. They actually become human habitats that are also potentially inhabited by plants and animals and all these channeling the flow of water, channeling the flow of wind, of air, of sunlight. And in that sense, I think we've reached a point of the maturity of our civilization where we really have the means to start designing cities that are like man-made landscapes rather than an ecological desert in the middle of the wild. We've done sort of a series of projects, like in Copenhagen we did the VM house, the mountain, the 8 house. The mountain becomes almost like a suburban landscape on top of a parking, exploring the difference between cars that want deep spaces close to the ground and apartments that want views and gardens and sunshine. The 8 house, we create like a three-dimensional community where you can actually walk and bicycle all the way to the penthouse and back down again. In New York, we're building a building that takes the European courtyard, the idea of creating an oasis in the middle of the city block, and combines it with the density of a skyscraper, so it becomes some strange, twisted courtyard building, but that actually nests a little bit of nature in the middle of the city block, which is a rare thing in Manhattan, which is otherwise this extremely dense urban environment. I think one thing that will always be true is that people are different. Ever increasingly, you see people have different cultural backgrounds. They have different family structures. You know, people also live longer. So you have like entirely new, you know, you have like really old people with resources, but without the time constraints of having a job. And they're going to live until they're 100 and they're going to remain fresh and healthy. So you have like all these things are constantly changing and that's opening up new possibilities. And then I also think specifically what really ties most of the housing projects we've done is that they somehow have a more blatant relationship with nature or social space or landscape. Like finally this idea of carving out a piece of nature in the middle of a Manhattan city block, creating essentially a Central Park, just 15,000 times smaller than the big one. So I think that's another thing, that the dichotomy between city and landscape is being reduced and people prefer an urban location because of the social and cultural and sort of professional opportunities of living in the city, but they also want to have an enjoyable life. So therefore, they might want to have a bigger terrace, or they might want to have a tree in the garden. I think very simply, our buildings look different because they perform differently. Like not only do we, of course, design the individual, I mean, I think the typical housing design is that you design a unit that works, and then depending on how your site looks, you add 8 of those units in the length, and then you stack another 6 of those units on top of each other, and then you have a housing building. And then you choose a facade material, and then you have to make it nice, so maybe you make a special detail on the balcony, or a special color or roof thing, and that's it. And I think what we try to do is that we try to start by considering the possibilities and the problems of the site. We try to optimize the way the site is inhabited. We also try to see, like, if we have different programs, instead of doing a parking structure next to an apartment building, we turn the parking into a man-made hillside so that all the apartments can be houses with gardens looking out over the view and to the south. And as a result, by having these initial concerns, where we almost like try to master plan the three-dimensional volume of the building, we get different sites with different qualities, and therefore the apartments become naturally differentiated. So in a way, by not just accumulating individually designed apartments that only care about where the cupboard is next to the kitchen sink, I think we try to look at the whole city block as almost a little master plan that you have to distribute and design. And by having this extra layer, like this big idea, the individual apartments somehow get enriched by their position in this urban whole. I like this idea that the way we design buildings is almost like playing Twister, if you know the game. So instead of, you know, a standard solution, you know, the stack of apartments on top of each other and next to each other, is quite often looking at only one criteria. So it's, you know, trying to orient the building in one way, and then it's just trying to make an efficient stack of apartments. But then it ignores the context, it ignores the potential views, it ignores the interest in diversity. It doesn't exploit the fact that maybe the upper apartments could have a special feature, or the one on the ground. So by stacking on more concerns, more criteria, it's like saying you don't only have to put your hand there and your foot there, and suddenly during the game of Twister, you suddenly find yourself with your face in close proximity of your friend's body parts. It's almost the same in architecture, that by stacking on criteria, we make the standard solution impossible, and we force the architecture into these backbending positions where it actually ends up looking really interesting and creating some really unexpected possibilities. Not because we don't care about all these different concerns and demands, but because we care about them almost religiously, so that by forcing ourselves to make everybody happy, we actually force the architecture into some really unusual composition, or some really sort of exciting form.
That was Danish architect Bjarke Ingels talking in Stockholm. Time for a short break, but stay tuned. We're off to the RIBA next to take a tour of their latest exhibition, A Place to Call Home.
The Urbanist is a show about the cities we live in, and it introduces you to the planners, thinkers and architects who want to make urban life rattle along like a well-tended tram, not grind to halt like a taxi with a flat tire.
We see that our community is changing, and we have two alternatives. We could make it an eyesore in the community, or we could make it a shining jewel, and we chose to make it a shining jewel.
Leave the countryside to the softies and listen to the show that knows that a bit of grit and bustle is good for you. That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 London time, here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back. Last week, the latest exhibition in the RIBA Home series opened. It's called A Place to Call Home, Where We Live and Why. Taking the British, or perhaps human, obsession with experiments that shape how and where we live, it's a thoroughly involving, interesting dissection of how living habits and conditions have changed over time. Monocle's David Pleasant popped along to hear more from Mike Allthorpe and Harry Rich.
What is it about the British and their homes? There's something so deep and sociological that links the British to the place that they call home that it leaves many somewhat baffled. The ambition to own your own home is stronger here than perhaps anywhere else. Why is this? And how has the design and architecture of Britain's homes had an impact? The Royal Institute of British Architecture is trying to answer some of these questions with a new exhibition. It's called A Place to Call Home, Where We Live and Why.
My name is Mike Allthorpe. I'm public programs manager at the RIBA and curator of A Place to Call Home. We've got an image here of the Alton East Estate in Roehampton in southwest London. This was designed by the London County Council Architects Department when the local authorities built large-scale housing in the late 1950s. The image you see here is of a picturesque view of late 50s housing. It's really fantastic because you have an image of children, of people using the estate, a place that you can recognise as home. It's trees, it's verges. It's children going for a game of cricket. There's a man washing a car. This is a lived-in place, a planned community, which is working. It's actually in action here. This is an image of architecture and community, of it being used as intended. It's quite Arcadian. It's not a standalone picture of a building. There's people in it. There's people doing things. There's a man washing a car in the background.
Here we have a rather striking model of Victorian terrace housing. Could you just talk a little bit about this and what it represents?
This is a specially commissioned model of the Shenfield area of Newcastle upon Tyne in northeast of the UK. This is here to illustrate the evolution of a building type we saw in the UK, which is taken for granted. This is a building form that came out of a set of standards which were imposed by local authorities or directed by local authorities. But these estates were developer built to minimum standards. So you have standard features like the width of the street, the width of the house, the access at the back. And so through a set of things on paper came to life through brick. Mm-hmm. It's about revealing the story behind something which we take for granted and people think is a norm. That really, actually, this was something brand new in the 1860s onwards, but actually came to colour most of the UK for that time and was really the landscape of British cities and, to a very large degree, still is.
So what happened next? Despite the British love affair with their homes, they often made much of their fear of the dreaded tower block, the child of the well-intentioned social housing programmes of the 1950s, 60s and 70s.
This is Keeling House, which was on Claredale Street in Bethnal Green, London, designed by Dennis Lasden in 1959. And it's not strictly a tower block, it's a cluster block. So we're talking about a series of towers linked together around a central core. And really, this model is fantastic. It's one that is in the RBA collections and represents a real advance of the theoretical discussion and application of modernist principles from that era.
Generally, kind of the concept is that Britain has never really kind of adopted modernism, or it somehow was a failure here. But this is really kind of high quality modernism. We always think that the great examples of modernism happened in France or America or South America. But this is a really nice example of really high standard, sculptural, fantastic modernism here in the UK.
No, absolutely. I mean, the UK was at the vanguard of architectural experiment at this time. In many ways, the UK was leading the world. It was one of those rare instances in history where Europe was looking to the UK. I mean, you saw the development of towers, vast variety of towers, all applying slightly different principles, different varieties of arrangements of areas for living, for relaxing, for playing, but also at the same time as the vast chunks of our cities were being rebuilt, we saw the development of new towns, and the UK did that in a very comprehensive way. But it's the application of a set of ideas and principles which architects were playing around with during the war, kind of waiting for their moments, waiting for that, and they really seized that. And we, the East End has this wonderful building as a real exemplar and icon of that time.
So what's the role of the architect in all this? Can architects realistically make a difference? I found the man who should be able to tell me.
Harry Rich, the chief executive at the RIBA. I don't know whether we're any more obsessed about our homes than anywhere else, to be truthful, but I think that clearly our homes say a massive amount about us. They reflect our character in some way and in some ways clearly shape our character. If you go home at the end of the day and like the place you're in, you might be somewhat happier than not. We do have this obsession here with owning our own home, which is a relatively new obsession. It's probably started, I guess, in the 80s. So I think that probably does differentiate us from some other northern European countries where rental is much more common.
It seems clear that where we live and why, in Britain at least, has little to do with design and perhaps even less to do with architecture, for most of us anyway. From Victorian terraces for workers to tower blocks and suburban semis, the hard politics and practicalities of life have often left the homeowner wanting in terms of standards. The RIBA's exhibition is striking for what it does not include. It does not show the ideal one-off homes that we expect from the architect's venerable home and institution. It is really a social history of the last 200 years.
For sure, architects are absolutely part of that solution. I mean, you know, there's a kind of three-way partnership, I guess, on new build homes. It's the developers, it's architects, and it's the consumers, and it's how that relationship works. I mean, most of the architects that I know would fall over themselves to design innovative, excellent new homes. Clearly, unfortunately, too often they're not given the chance. But again, whilst I know that's true, on its own, that doesn't answer the problem.
With or without architects, the place we call home is undeniably important. If we love or loathe where we live, it is more than likely to affect us accordingly. What you thought was your humble terraced house or post-war apartment is in fact a working piece of design archaeology. House hunting will never be the same again.
That was Monocle's David Pleasant with Mike Althorpe and Harry Rich at the RIBA in London. And that wraps things up for this week's Section D. Next week, we're dipping into the world of fashion, talking to Paul Smith, eavesdropping on the goings-on at London Fashion Week, that's us, not Sir Paul, and looking at men's fashion retail ruling the tills around the world. Tune in then. Today's show was produced by Gillian DeBias, our researcher was Taya Erdl, and our editor was Holly Fisher. I'm Hugo MacDonald. Goodbye.